Okay, well, thanks very much, Peter, for the invitation to this nice workshop. My talk is really an introduction to the next talk, and maybe to some extent some of the later talks, too. I'm really going to focus on some pedagogical things having to do with the background that's needed to understand these interesting equations called the average d'Euler equations and their viscous counterparts. So that's what I'm going to mainly focus on here, is the necessary background. So I'm going to begin by trying to summarize in a reasonably concise way how solutions of the Euler equations can be regarded as geodesics on the diffeomorphism group. And I want to explain a little bit of background of Euler-Poincaré theory and use it to explain the context of these isotropic averaged Euler equations. And then there'll be a similar theme for the anisotropic case that Steve's going to talk about. You might ask, what's the purpose of the kind of geometric approach here? Well, there are lots of them, and we'll be discussing some of them. But for instance, if you care about existence and uniqueness and smoothness, it gives those right away. Some of the smoothness results are actually subtle, and they're not obvious. For instance, if you write the equations in Lagrangian representation, the solutions vary smoothly with the initial data. But if you write the equations in Eulerian representation, the solutions only depend continuously on the initial data. Things like that are subtle. And this framework allows you to distinguish them and prove all of these things in an easy and unified way. And in addition, we'll talk about convergence results as viscosity tends to zero. One of the neat things about the averaged equations is this allows this to happen even in the presence of boundaries. And I want to also put in context some of the variational structure of the Euler and averaged Euler equations. I'm not going to say anything about other than an allusion to the Hamiltonian structure. There just isn't time to do all of that. Another interesting benefit is one gets new insight into things like vortex methods. This is work of Scholler and Olver. This is Marcel Olver. And for instance, if you look at these Chorin-Beal-Mida vortex blobs, they give you honest, weak solutions of these averaged equations, for instance. And if you look at the anisotropic counterpart, it seems as though things like the Zabuski type of vortex blobs probably, in some sense, are going to be weak solutions of the anisotropic case. So this is certainly a very interesting thing. So when I say this, I don't mean in some vague sense. I mean, I really mean literally that these things, with the appropriate choice of cutoff that's governed by a particular Bessel function, that these really are exactly weak solutions of these equations. And I also want to point out that the general geometric framework that is developed here is in fact what led and fostered, nurtured, whatever you want to say, the derivation of these averaged equations. So Steve's going to go into the actual derivation of the equations in his talk. So in putting this all in historical perspective, one has to pay the appropriate homage to Poincaré. Poincaré actually knew a lot of this stuff, and it was rediscovered perhaps 100 times since then. But because of Poincaré's work, we call the general equations that describe rigid body type systems the Euler-Poincaré equations. These equations include rigid body and the Euler fluid equations as special cases. And it's that general setup that allows us to properly understand this averaging process and the equations too. And it was Poincaré who really started this subject. He had lots of interesting insights and lots of interesting papers. It seems as though he already knew about things like geometric phases and all sorts of things. I could go on about the history for a long time. But with that bit of homage, let me remind you about some of the elementary background here that's important notation and important conceptual things for what I want to talk about. Is it possible to turn this first row of lights off here? I think it might be. Yeah, that's good, thanks. So let's just recall a bit of notation. I'll let U of X and T denote the velocity field, and for most of the talk I'll be talking about flows in Euclidean space, but it could be on a general Riemannian manifold. That's perfectly fine. And we let eta denote the particle trajectories. So eta satisfies this equation. So just keep in mind, eta and u are related in the standard, very simple way. Eta is the particle trajectories for the velocity field u. Now, if you're working on flow in a fixed domain, so no free boundaries here, I mean, one can do that case too, but in fixed domains, this eta t, you know, as long as you're in the region where these things exist, this is going to be a diffeomorphism, volume preserving if U is divergence free. So eta for each fixed T belongs to this group. And we make precise as necessary the exact differentiability class. Of course, the Euler equations for ideal flow are given this way. And it's always nice to write them in Lie derivative form like this. For instance, that makes understanding the vorticity equation very easy. Just take the exterior derivative through that equation, you see everything right away. And of course, the Euler equations in Euclidean coordinates are there. These x's? Why do you say that? These are the Lagrangian labels, right? I would normally write these with big X's. That's completely correct. Yes, these are Eulerian labels. That's correct. Okay, so Poincaré more or less knew that the Euler equations for ideal flow are the Euler-Poincaré equations on the Lie algebra of this group. The Lie algebra of this group is just the algebra of divergence-free vector fields parallel to the boundary. Arnold sharpened that up, although he actually didn't know about Poincaré's work, more or less rediscovered it, but he certainly said it in a very clear fashion, namely, U satisfies the Euler equations if and only if this curve is an L2 geodesic on that group. That's Arnold's theorem. Knowing about Euler-Poincaré theory, this is really a triviality. At the time, it seemed very startling and surprising, but it's honestly a triviality if you know Euler-Poincaré theory. And I'll get to why I say that shortly. What David Eben and I showed was that if you, instead of looking at the equations in Eulerian representation, if you look at them in material representation, that is, if you look at the equations as differential equations on this group, then the evolution operator governing those equations is smooth. And with that, I mean, that's surprising because the Euler equations are a PDE. But what I'm saying is when you write them in Lagrangian representation, they're an ODE. The vector field governing their evolution is smooth, therefore existence and uniqueness is trivial. The smoothness, though, is not trivial. That's a hard result. That context is what allowed us to prove in the absence of boundary that solutions of Navier-Stokes converge to solutions of Euler as viscosity goes to zero. Around that time, we, of course, I was at Berkeley, we were talking to Kato, right? Kato was doing his stuff around the same time. We were talking to each other a lot. So that was an interesting development. This formalism also allows you to give easy proofs of things like Chorin's formula for an interplay of projecting onto the divergence-free part and solving the unconstrained equations. Those things fall out right away from this setup. Any dimension. Yes. Yes, any dimension.
No boundaries.
No boundaries. In there. It means either periodic or unbounded or on manifolds with no boundary, like flow on a sphere. Right? Any of those cases.
And for as long as the solution is smooth.
Yeah. Now, historically, there was all kinds of other related developments. Sorry about the spelling mistakes there. But, for instance, the Hamiltonian structure of fluid mechanics was undergoing a lot of development around the same time. For instance, to write the Euler equations in Poisson bracket form, to understand in a deeper way the Hamiltonian structure of the Kirchhoff model and various things of that sort. Things related to hydrodynamic stability, all sorts of other kinds of problems, MHD, plasma physics, et cetera, links with bifurcations, and so on and so on. Lots of other related developments have been occurring for a long time in this general topic, including things like geometric phases and so on. It's all very interesting. I'll come back a little bit to some of these topics when I sum up and look to some future developments. So let's just pass by that. So let me go back and explain in a little more detail this Euler-Poincaré theory. Because even though it's 100 years old, it's not that well known, and it's really fundamental to what we're doing. Yeah? So these are the Euler-Poincaré equations. There's a little bit of notation there, but let me go back and forth between these and the rigid body equations, and perhaps that'll help a little bit. See, in the rigid body equations, one knows that they have this general structure. Omega is the body angular velocity of a rotating rigid body. The derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to omega for the particular case of the rigid body, that'll be the body angular momentum. So this just says the time rate of change of the body angular momentum is itself cross omega. So those are the standard rigid body equations that everybody knows. In this case, the Lie algebra is the rotation group. The Lagrangian little l is just the usual rotational kinetic energy of the rigid body. And notice in the equations there's, of course, this cross product, and that generalizes to the Lie algebra bracket on a general Lie algebra. So that's encoded in this add operator. This add operator is just the operator that brackets. And add star, naturally, is its dual. Of course, in infinite dimensions, you have to be careful about the spaces, etc. So the Lagrangian here is, whatever you choose it to be, then these are the general Euler-Poincaré equations. Very simple. Yep. So I hope you get a feel for those from the rigid body case here. And The nice thing is that the regular Euler equations that we wrote down before, in fact, are also Euler-Poincaré equations. You choose the Lie algebra to be the algebra of divergence-free vector fields. The Lagrangian is just the kinetic energy of the fluid. Then you just turn the Euler-Poincaré crank. That is, you just work out what the Euler-Poincaré equations are for these choices, and indeed you get the Euler equations. So on that level, it seems very simple. But there's more deeper stuff going on, because these Euler-Poincaré equations don't just pop out of the blue. They arise by reduction. Namely, start with a group level and think about a Lagrangian on the entire group. So it's a function of the group configuration and its dot. So for fluids, this is going to be eta and eta dot. Right? Eta dot is the material velocity. It's not the spatial velocity. If you form this quantity, eta dot, eta inverse, that's the spatial velocity field. So this mapping of gg dot into psi, that's the mapping from the material representation to the spatial representation. For the rigid body, it would take the attitude matrix and the time derivative of the attitude matrix and map it to the body angular velocity. Except in the rigid body case, you have to be careful about left versus right. Yeah? Why do you be careful about left versus right? Well, it's just a fact that the kinetic energy for a fluid is a right invariant Lagrangian, whereas that for a rigid body is a left invariant Lagrangian. You just check that by looking at the expression. And the Lagrangian is, of course, just the kinetic energy. There's no doubt about how you should write it down from physical principles. Now, given that Lagrangian on TG, it defines the Lagrangian on the Lie algebra this way. Yeah, so they're related in a simple way. Okay, now if you start with this Lagrangian L, we have standard Euler-Lagrange equations up on the group. So this group element G, it makes sense to say that satisfies the standard Euler-Lagrange equations. Euler-Poincaré theorem says that this G satisfies the standard Euler-Lagrange equations for this L if and only if Xi satisfies the Euler-Poincaré equations for little l. That's Euler-Poincaré reduction. So that general fact gives Arnold's theorem right away, just by making the choices that I showed. And in fact, proving this abstractly, this is not very deep if you do it right. And I'll show you in the next slides how to, quote, do it right. If you try it by hand, it's surprisingly tricky. But if you make use of variational principles, it's really pretty simple. Okay, so I've said this already. Now, let me say how this works for variational principles. So up on the group, we have the standard Hamilton principle, right? And that gives the standard Euler-Lagrange equations. So, in fact, if you write the Euler's fluid equations in material representation, they become second-order equations for eta, correct? Those second-order equations are Euler-Lagrange equations. I don't know who first discovered that fact, but it certainly goes a long ways back, although it's surprisingly not well known. In general, in Euler-Poincaré theory, this is the variational principle on the group. This is the variational principle on the Lie algebra, except when you reduce, you must constrain the variations like this. Yeah, you must only look at variations that have a particular form of that for some xi. And then this principle is equivalent to the Euler-Poincaré equations. Now, passing from this principle to its reduction down here through the change of variables, xi equals g dot g inverse, is really pretty simple. So the good way to prove the Euler-Poincaré theorem is to first prove this is equivalent to that, and then work out the Euler-Lagrange equations here and the corresponding differential equations here. Now, where does this constraint come from? So let me say that. You see, up on the group here, when you take variations, you take variations of paths, right, between two fixed group elements. Now, when you reduce that, It turns out you don't get all possible variations. You only get some, and this is exactly what you get, variations of this form. So, for instance, if you were varying the velocity field in a fluid, would you take a variation that was not implementable by a variation in the particle positions? Maybe. Maybe you wouldn't think about that. I don't know. But that's exactly what this says. It says if you want to vary the velocity field of a fluid, only take variations that are implemented by a variation in the particle positions. Yeah, so it has very good physical meaning. Here it is concretely for the case of fluids. It says the variation has that form. This W is actually the particle position variation written in spatial representation. In the fluids literature, I mean, since the time of Poincaré, I guess, lots of people have sort of rediscovered, thought about this in various points of view. They're often known as Lin constraints. They're closely related to that. Okay, so this is a quick run-through of Euler-Poincaré theory for fluids, and of course, there's a Hamiltonian counterpart to all of that, which I haven't talked about, basically related to this picture through the Legendre transformation. So, just to emphasize, up on the group, the Euler equations have the standard Hamiltonian form of, if you like, F dot equals F bracket H for the standard canonical bracket. After reduction, you get a non-canonical bracket called the Lee-Poisson bracket. So there's a general theory for that, and it's very beautiful in the case of fluids. For example, it allows you to understand right away what the Hamiltonian structure of vortex dynamics is. Vortex filaments, for example, evolve by the Hamiltonian structure, associated to the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. For instance, that falls right out of this theory. Yes? It's independent of the, from the physical meaning, it's clear it's independent of the incompressibility constraint. And I'm not sure what you mean by additional things. It's related to the fact, it's related to vorticity conservation, ultimately. It's related to that. Yes? Yes? It's not a constraint in the same sense. It's a constraint in the variational principle. It's a constraint on what allowed variations you can take. So Lagrange multiplier does not appear in the same way. Yeah. It's the Lagrangian counterpart. If you're on the Hamiltonian side, we know that vorticity is conserved and you stay on isovortical surfaces. If you like, it's a Lagrangian counterpart of that. It's not the same thing, it's a counterpart. Yes, if you're on the Hamiltonian side and you work out what the Hamiltonian structure is for vortex filaments, from the Hamiltonian reduction theory, the nonlinear Schrodinger structure for vortex filaments pops right out. It's, of course, compatible to Hashimoto. Hashimoto's in addition to what I just said. Yes? Yes, but that nonlinear Schrodinger structure has nothing to do, from this point of view, it has nothing to do with the local induction approximation. If you wanted to make up other vortex line models, which you can equally well do, right, in the averaged Euler equations, you get things closely related to the Klein and Mida structures, yeah? But the geometry is the same. So, Yes. We don't, but lots of other people do using this framework, like Langer and Perlin, for example. I have a lovely paper about that. They explain the multi-Hamiltonian structure in a systematic way, getting the integrable hierarchy from this kind of a structure.
I was asking what I mean by phi, or phi is a variable in the integrator.
Yeah. Well, I can't, but I would not off the top of my head, but I think Langer and Perlein do. So I just refer you to that. That's tangential to my talk, so I don't want to get off on that. Okay, so now what are we going to do? We're going to replace L2 geodesics by H1 geodesics. And what's neat about this is that that's not just a mathematical game. You might think it is at the beginning, but it's physically interesting, and it's related to an averaging of the equations over small scales. As I said, the averaging process is what Steve's going to talk about. And let me put this in a bit of historical perspective, because historically this is how this arose, namely with this one-dimensional shallow water equation, the Kamasa-Holm equation, which you can also write this way. This is a completely integrable one-dimensional equation, and one of the many things that makes it interesting is that it has non-smooth solitons. Now, these equations happen to be Euler-Poincaré equations. Yeah? And the Lagrangian is not an L2 norm, but an H1 norm. Yeah? So that's more or less in this paper here. Yeah? Just because it's identified with Euler-Poincaré equations, we know automatically from Euler-Poincaré theory that you get H1 geodesics on that group. Up until recently, Steve had the best smoothness existence results for that. I guess that's now been somewhat superseded, but still, this Kamasa-Holm equation has exactly the same remarkable property that the Euler equations for an ideal fluid had. Namely, if you write these equations in material representation here, those become ODEs instead of PDEs. There's no derivative loss. Yeah? Even though in these equations there is a derivative loss. Huh? What do you evolve? What do you
evolve?
So? The second equation differentiates V. Okay. Whatever you want to say. I'm not saying this is deep from a PDE point of view, but it's a terminological thing. This equation loses derivatives, right? The right-hand side of the equation is not as smooth as V. It's a terminological thing, okay? I agree, it's not serious, but let's not argue over semantics. I think there's certainly a difference between writing this in spatial representation and in Lagrangian representation. In Lagrangian representation, when you write dv dt or du dt equals something, the term on the right-hand side is just as smooth as the left-hand side. Yeah? There's literally no loss of derivatives. So existence and uniqueness there is really simple. I want to point out that part of this is related to another remarkable fact about the KdV equation, namely their Euler-Poincaré equations too. The Lie algebra in that case is the Bott-Virasoro algebra. Okay. Now, let me talk a little bit about bring us a little more up to date. In 98, Daryl and Tudor and I developed this Euler-Poincaré point of view, and we gave a formal derivation of the averaged Euler equations and applied it to lots of other types of fluid equations, that general theory. So these are the averaged Euler equations. If you like, they're a higher dimensional counterpart of the one-dimensional Kamasa-Holm equations, but these ones are incompressible, so we ask that U be divergence-free. So now the derivative loss, I think you'll agree, is slightly more subtle. Okay, how do you prove smooth dependence on initial data in material representation? Smooth, not continuous, smooth. It's not going on characteristics because of the pressure constraint. Well, I think you have to do something. Okay, in any case, if you do it, if you literally, I mean, there's many ways to do this, I agree. If you literally transform these equations to material representation and you note smoothness, it's literally one line. However you do it, you get smooth. You get C infinity dependence on time, C infinity dependence, even if the data is rough. You get smooth dependence on the initial conditions, smooth dependence on the initial conditions. Of course, in spatial representation, you don't get smooth dependence on initial conditions. Anyway, this all falls out in a very natural, nice way. So here in these equations, V and U are related by this operator here. Okay, and there are various kinds of boundary conditions. Let's focus on, say, the no-slip boundary conditions, U equals zero. I'll skip over the other ones since I'm running out of time. Now, if this length parameter alpha tends to zero, you formally recover the usual Euler equations. It's interesting also that these equations, these averaged Euler equations, are identical to the equations of a second grade fluid. Now, if you want to see the vorticity structure of these equations, again, it's interesting that you can write them in Lie derivative form like this. So by taking the exterior derivative through there, you immediately see what the vorticity structure is. For example, if you look at the vorticity as a two-form, then it's advected by the flow this way. So if you push forward the initial vorticity as a two-form by the flow map, you get the vorticity at time t. That, of course, holds in any number of dimensions. In two dimensions, pushing forward means advecting as a scalar. In higher dimensions, it's advection as a two-form. Okay, so So this Euler-Poincaré framework is what led us to consider these equations. The first published analytical work on the of these equations was given in papers by Steve and our papers with Ratio. And in this recent work, and what Steve's going to talk about, is a careful derivation of the equations to study the anisotropic case. Now, an important ingredient in this is the rate of deformation tensor. So recall that's the definition of the rate of deformation tensor. There it is in coordinates. And we'll also need the corresponding version with indices lowered. So in coordinates, that's defined this way. U is the velocity field. In Euclidean space, it makes no difference. But say on a sphere, it makes a difference how you write the indices. This tensor here is related to the rate of change of the metric tensor. Now, if you carefully go through the derivation, what naturally pops out is this quantity here as the H1 form of the energy. It's not quite the standard H1 norm, but it's equivalent to it by various Korn inequalities. So in Euclidean space, this would just be the L2 norm of U plus alpha squared times the L2 norm of this deformation field here, this rate of deformation tensor. And now you turn the Euler-Poincaré crank and you find that you get this theorem, that this eta t is a geodesic with respect to the metric defined by that Lagrangian, if and only if U itself satisfies the averaged Euler equation. So in other words, the averaged Euler equations are related to H1 geodesics in exactly the same way as the Euler equations are related to L2 geodesics. So this is no big deal by using the Euler-Poincaré theory. Now in the anisotropic case, there's going to be an additional advected tensor F that gets coupled with these equations, and that makes use of a version of Euler-Poincaré theory that allows advected quantities, and that was a theory that was worked out a few years ago in this paper of Daryl and Tudor and myself. That's a Lagrangian counterpart to semi-direct product theory. And of course, advected quantities, be they advected scalars, tensors, etc., occur in many interesting examples like MHD, etc. Okay, so we've talked enough about well-posedness. It is remarkable, I think, that these equations have exactly the same smoothness property as the Euler equations. And if you want to use that to read off these existence and uniqueness theorems, that's fine. If you want to use some other method, that's fine too. This method here does suggest a number of interesting things. For instance, given two nearby diffeomorphisms, you can uniquely join them with a solution of these equations, for instance. The spray just means the right-hand side of the differential equations. Write them as d variable dt equals something variable. That something is a smooth map, smooth, C-infinity map. No derivative loss. There's a viscous analog of these averaged Euler equations. And one version of this viscous analog is to put in the dissipation this way. And when you do it this way, these are the same equations as you get for a viscous second grade fluid. And some people... a second grade fluid. Anyway, those are the equations, whatever your terminology is. Okay, so for instance, in the work of Daryl and Edris and Cyprian, they use a different viscous term, and that's this one. Now, this is bound to end up in lots of discussion and debate, and let's defer this to lunch, but let me just... summarize the reasons we use for choosing this term instead of that one. Well, in the second grade fluid literature, they would say you must choose this one for reasons like material frame indifference. And I'll let Steve comment about this. If you think about adding Brownian motion to the derivation of the equations, then what pops out is this and not that. And, there's also some reasons why this kind of a term is okay for various models like channel flow and so on. Anyway, I think the jury is still out on exactly what is the right way to model dissipation in these equations. In any case, I think from any point of view, including Peter's point of view or this point of view, what's interesting here is not so much the, you know, how you prove this, but what's interesting here is that for these averaged equations with the new Laplacian U term in there, you get convergence as the viscosity goes to zero, even in the case of boundaries. U equals zero on the boundary. Yes. Yes. The boundary conditions are exactly the same, and that's what makes it not unreasonable.
There are no boundary layers.
In this theory, there are no boundary layers. That's correct. You have to remember that these are looking at the flow in some kind of average sense, which Steve will go into in more detail. Now, I mean, that somehow you should get this convergence in some kind of a sense on the average has been discussed a lot in the literature. If you look in a lot of Ansager's writings, for example, you can read, you know, statements that maybe are suggestive of this. Anyway, it's a little bit wishy-washy. Okay, I'm about done. Let me skip over. I mean, I mentioned before there are all these interesting product formulas to show their convergence. These are of numerical interest. I'll just skip over that. One can show that. Of course, we have to do more testing and comparison. Bassam Bamier, who's here, he's done a lot of interesting work on boundary layers, and we are talking with him about hooking up what we're doing with boundary layer models. Things like pipe and channel flow are very challenging from this point of view, and that's important to do that. I want to just mention very briefly from the numerical point of view, there's a lot of evidence accumulating these days that using structured algorithms is very important. For instance, here's an example where if you use a high-order integrator like a fourth-order Runge-Kutta on a conservative mechanical system compared to a variational integrator which preserves the discrete form of the variational structure, you'll see how much better the energy behaves in time with these structured integrators than a higher-order accurate unstructured integrator. And that works, that's also the case even with dissipation. If you take a structured integrator on a dissipative system, it will dissipate the energy correctly, even for long time runs. Whereas an unstructured, even higher order accurate integrator completely gets the solution wrong after a reasonable amount of time. So the nature, the structured nature of the algorithm that you want to use is very important, and in the future, this is one of the exciting and interesting directions, is to insert this into this kind of thing into various fluid codes. This is a sort of a standard MATLAB one that's not symplectic. Symplectic Runge-Kutta schemes would behave nicely. Yeah, this is one of the standard MATLAB fourth order Runge-Kutta integrators, but not structured. Huh? This black curve here is a costly one. That's a benchmark calculation. This Runge-Kutta one and this one cost about the same. Yeah. Depend, implicit, explicit, there are, I mean, this is a whole other story. Let's not get into that. We can do it explicit, implicit, whatever you want. Some problems, implicit's much better. Some problems, explicit's much better. Depends on the problem. But the phenomena is the same. Explicit, implicit, doesn't matter. Okay. So I better let Steve go now.